Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is David George Haskell. His work integrates scientific, literary, and contemplative studies of the natural world. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of the South in Tennessee. He's also written about biology, ethics, and human culture for the New York Times and other publications. His latest book, Sounds Wild and Broken, is a fascinating read, charting the first sounds in the atmosphere predating life on Earth. David, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Thank you, Georgina. It's such a pleasure to be with you and talk about sound here in this sonic space.
Absolutely, over the radio waves. Yeah. So, first of all, perhaps you could just outline your very first fascination with sound.
Well, I think we're all sonic beings. Regardless of the state of our ears, we pick up vibrations in the womb from the deep pulsations of our mother's heart. And then as we emerge into the world, we connect to one another through language and music. And of course, I shared those, as we all do, those experiences. But it wasn't until I was in college and then in graduate school that I met people who devoted their lives to listening to the voices of other creatures, other species, particularly birds. And so attending to the sounds of birds became an entryway. And when I started learning that the individual voices of different species, and indeed of different individuals within a species, it was as if a new sense had been plugged into my body. Suddenly I was aware of all the variations in the daily cycle of night and day, and of the cycles of the seasons. And so birds were really the gateway drug, if you like, into deeper listening. And then after that, I expanded that curiosity sort of back into the human realm to ask, how does the music of the more than human world, the music of birds and insects and flowing rivers, how does that relate to things like the origins of human music and human language?
The book is subtitled Sonic Marvels, Evolution's Creativity and the Crisis of Sensory Extinction. Are we facing a crisis?
I do think we're embedded in multiple crises of injustice, of climate change, and those are important crises, and I don't mean to diminish them in any way. I think we need to have a complementary frame to those ways of thinking, which are about atmospheric chemical concentrations and species extinctions. And life is made of interconnection. How does interconnection happen? It happens through the senses. And so in addition to thinking about chemistry and statistics, we need to think about our senses, the lived experience of species. And sound is particularly important because sound, for hundreds of millions of years now, has been the main conduit by which many creatures connect one to another over long distances. And when those connections are broken or frayed, when sonic diversity diminishes, we lose not just some of the marvels and riches of the planet, but some of the forces that actually produce new diversity that help ecosystems and communities be resilient. So we're not just losing sensory ornament, we're losing some of the creative forces of life itself.
So at the beginning, all there was the sounds of the earth. Tell us what the very first sounds were and where they came from.
Yeah, the first sounds on Earth were the primal sounds of wind and waves crashing onto the beaches and thunder and lightning and geologic tremors. And we can still hear those primal sounds today. Go to a place where the voices of living beings and engine noise are lower, say on a seashore or windy mountaintop. You can hear the sounds of the Earth as they would have been billions of years ago. And then life evolved and added its own sounds. Even single-celled creatures like bacteria make tiny little sound waves as they grow and move. Now, those sound waves, as far as we know, seem to be incidental to their growth and their movement. There's no known bacterium that has a song or that cries out little warning signals to its neighbors. That yet may be discovered. Our knowledge about the sounds of bacteria is actually pretty rudimentary. But then, after bacteria evolved, of course, hundreds of millions of years pass, and then we have complex animals evolve. Another few hundreds of millions of years happened in communicative silence. Complex animals were walking around on land, swimming in the sea, making crunching sounds with their mouths and scrabbling sounds with their feet. But as far as we know, they weren't communicating until quite late, until about 300 million years ago, when the first insects on land started to make little communicative sounds connecting one to another. And in the oceans, it might have been around the same time that some of the first sounds that linked creatures across great distance through sonic vibrations when they first evolved.
How can we know this, though? How can we know when sound first started emitting from creatures?
Yes, unfortunately, of course, sound doesn't fossilize, but what we can infer from fossils is look for sound-making devices on the remains. For example, some of the first known singing insects, how do we know that they made a sound? Well, the fossilized remains of their wings have little ridges on the wings. Those ridges are covered in little nubs, just like the ridges and nubs that you would find on a modern cricket. That's how crickets make their chirping sounds, is by rubbing their wings together. And so by finding structures like that, or a fossil of the avian syrinx, so the little sound-making structure that all birds have down in their chests, if we can find fossilized remains of one, we know that the birds were probably singing at that point. The other source of information is more indirect. Say, with frogs, we can trace their family tree and use genetic clocks to figure out where different branches of the frog family tree broke off from one another. And we can say that all the singing frogs that are alive today, if we trace them back, their common ancestor was about 200 million years ago. And so it's quite likely that that common ancestor was singing. It's not proof, it's not for sure, but it's a fairly good inference. So using direct physical evidence and then the indirect evidence of the genealogy of life, we can piece together this story that goes back deep into time.
And of course, if creatures are making sounds, creatures are also now evolved to listen.
Yes, and hearing predated communicative sounds by a long time, right from the very start of animal evolution. Animals had little tiny hairs on their bodies called cilia that picked up vibrations both within the body but also in the fluid and the air around the body. Those tiny little hairs became the foundation for hearing. And hearing is really just picking up movements, trembling movements in either the air or the water or solids. Sound can flow through any kind of medium in that way. And those are the little tiny little hair cells that we have in our inner ears that pick up sound. Insects have them in the joints of their legs and at the base of their antennae. Jellyfish have them on their bodies. Fish have them actually buried down into little canals in their skin as well as in inner ears. So an enormous diversity, a marvelous diversity of ways of hearing. But they all have this underlying cellular unity in that the cellular structures used to pick up the vibrating sounds are very, very similar, in fact, have a common origin among animals. And I find that just extraordinary that when I hear a sound, or when a cricket or a fish hears a sound, our diverse experiences are actually mediated through a shared ancestry, a shared cellular experience.
It's all just quite extraordinary, isn't it? It's not something that people who don't study it think about that much at all. You then go on to talk about the flourishing of animal sounds. You talk about predators and silence and flowers and oceans. Tell us more.
Yes. So once sound, communicative sound, started appearing and evolving, it quickly then flourished on Earth. And there were some things that really helped boost the sonic diversity of the world. So if we walk outside now and listen to a woodland or a city park and hear all the various insects and frogs and birds and human languages, there are some reasons why the world is so sonically diverse now. One of those is seemingly an absurd assertion, but I think it's a pretty solid one, is that flowers played a really important part. So if you look at the family tree of many singing creatures, particularly the insects that make sound, grasshoppers, crickets, bees, moths. Moths make all sorts of little ultrasonic songs with their wings. They burst into great profusion right when flowering plants are expanding. Why is that? It's because flowering plants are great at forming connections with other creatures, particularly other animals, and co-evolving with them and becoming an engine of biodiversity. So that engine of biodiversity caused the sounds of the world to increase in their range. Why? Because as you increase biodiversity, there is more opportunities for evolution to explore different ways of different structures for making sound. For example, grasshoppers have a completely different way of making sound than crickets. They rub their hind, the grasshoppers rub their hind legs on a sort of washboard-like mechanism, whereas crickets have structures in their wings. Birds sing in their chest. We make sounds from our throats. All of these creatures got a great big boost from the evolution of flowering plants. So when we listen to the wonders of sound in the world, we have to give some thanks to flowers. With mammals, we need to thank our great-great-grandmothers who first started feeding their offspring with the gift of milk. So when lactation evolved, which is, of course, only found in mammals, an amazing bond between mothers and their offspring, giving really, really dense, nutritionally powerful food to help the young grow really, really fast, much faster than any reptile or non-milk-producing animal can grow. That necessitated a reworking of the jaw and the mouth. So these little baby animals became really good at suckling to get the milk. And by reworking of the mouth, I mean the muscles and the jaw bones and the jaws down in the throat, the hyoid bones, all became more sturdy and complex in early mammals. And then evolution soon put those innovations to work in shaping sounds. So when I'm doing the complex work of shaping my breath into words right now, I'm relying on the legacy of those great-great-great-grandmothers and the evolution that they induced in the throat and jaw of mammals. When you hear a coyote or a wolf howling, the same thing, or a red deer roaring, they are using their own mammalian apparatus that also is there because of the ancestors who gave us the gift of milk. So mammalian sound relates to those early stages of the evolution of lactation.
And you write that human speech and hearing reveal our nature as a large mammal of open grasslands and savanna. And you go on to talk about language and how we talk is also influenced by our diet, by climate, by vegetation. Tell us more.
Yes. Yeah, so like all other species on the planet, all other vocal species, the kinds of sounds that we make are suited to the habitats in which we live. So a forest-dwelling bird, for example, usually they make slow whistled songs that sound to our ears quite melodious. These are songs that transmit very well through the dense vegetation of a woodland. Whereas a species of open country, a songbird, for example, that lives in grassland, tends to make very rapid, virtuosic, trilling sounds. And so other species have adapted their sounds to their environment. Seagulls, why do seagulls sound the way they do? Because their harsh, loud calls can be carried over the voice of the rumbling roar of waves on the shore. The same is true for humans. Our voices are voices that adapted to what was our ancestral habitat, fairly open savanna, not dense rainforest, the way, say, chimpanzees, our relatives, live in rainforests. And their ways of making sound, they generally, and in fact of hearing, they have much better high-frequency hearing, which is very useful in the forests, and many of their vocalizations are higher pitch, which actually matches that method of hearing in the forest. So we have voices suited to carrying through habitats like the savanna, and then our languages fit our diets. So for example, English developed as a language of agrarian people. So my English ancestors ate a lot of gruel, you know, barley and oats, and you know, a lot of fairly soft foods. That meant that we have, and this is true of agrarian societies worldwide, not just of the English, our overbite, which is the front teeth coming over the bottom teeth, persists into adulthood. We have quite childish mouths because our mouths never get a workout. So our language has a lot of words like f and v, favorite, fulvous, favored. These are words that are quite easy to make with mouths that are adapted to soft foods. Whereas hunter-gatherer societies eat much tougher foods. In adults of hunter-gatherers, the top teeth meet the lower teeth. They meet edge to edge. There's no overbite there. And this changes the way that they speak. They have many fewer of those sounds, which are hard to make when you have edge to edge tooth connection. And so the musicality, if you like, of language is a reflection of ecology and diet.
It's so extraordinary. It also feeds into sexuality and beauty. And I wondered if you'd tell us more about that.
Well, yes. I mean, who doesn't want to talk about sexuality and beauty? So, yeah, it turns out, you know, of course, many vocal productions of animals are about mating. Insects, for example, advertising where they are so other mates can find them. Birds and deer and frogs showing off how vigorous they are. So that there's an awful lot of sexiness in making sounds. And that sexiness becomes an evolutionary force in its own right. Because it turns out that when, and Darwin was the first one to point this out, that when creatures are, when members say one sex finds something attractive in another sex, that attractiveness feeds on itself and tends to lead to evolutionary exaggeration. So the song of a bird or the loud song of a frog is a form of a peacock's tail, if you like, but the peacock's tail here is expressed in sound. And the sound, you know, the exaggeration of the signal gets more and more acute over time, more crazy, and causes species to diverge from one another. Why is it that every species of bird and frog and mammal sounds so radically different from the others? Partly it's because of these sexual dynamics that are an evolutionary force causing diversification. So mating cries and mating songs are not just about advertising, oh, I'm strong, or I've got the territory, or I'm healthy. They're also saying, I understand the social dynamics of this species, and I can fit the fashions, the aesthetic fashions of what sounds good and what other members of the species think sounds good. And those fashions change century by century, and they change in different populations. So when you go out in the springtime and hear all these diverse voices, you have sexual selection, a form of evolution, to thank for that. And that's one form of an experience of beauty. Other forms of beauty, particularly for humans, are not sexual. They're the beauty of, say, the sounds of home. It turns out that we, when we're growing up, even if we're not consciously paying attention to it, we remember the bird songs and the sounds of the city street in which we grew up. And then years later, when we hear those, we have this experience of coming home. It's a very emotional experience that draws us back into the past through those long buried sonic memories that are another form of beauty. So beauty is also a compass and a guide to our place within the world. And in a rapidly changing world, of course, those compasses and guides can get confused and can also cause distress when soundscapes change, and we find it hard to cope with those rapid changes.
So for instance, in cities,
yes, cities are sort of paradoxical in that some of the sounds in the cities we find actually quite appealing. You know, we get lots of energy from the city, and particularly in our home neighborhoods in the city, we find those sounds often pleasing. It's like, yeah, that's the sound of home. Those people on the street chatting, this particular bird, a little bit of airplane noise overhead. So those things can actually feel pleasant and relaxing and root us in a particular place. But on the other hand, many city sounds are actually physiologically very harmful to us. Even if we're used to the sound of traffic or the overflight of airplanes, our blood pressure goes up when we're in the presence of loud and particularly uncontrolled and uncontrollable noise. And that inflames our body, actually causes heart disease, and it fragments and degrades the learning potential of little children in schools. So urban sounds create problems for us at the level of our psyches and also physiologically within our bodies. The same is true for other species. If you're a bird trying to make yourself heard in the city, if you're in too noisy of a place, you might not be able to breed because you cannot hear, or you can only hear very faintly, the breeding sounds of other species. So their social networks, for example, have been fragmented and destroyed.
And this is the crisis that you're addressing. Yeah. Just to talk about listening for a moment. You talk about listening in community.
Yes. We're familiar with this idea when it comes to music, right? And particularly when we're not in a pandemic, one of the things that is so wonderful about human society is that we gather together to have a communal, collective experience of being in the presence of sound waves that other people have made. It could be in an opera house, it could be around the jukebox in a pub, it could be in a classical orchestra playing outside or in an orchestra hall. or going to a rock concert in a stadium. All these different experiences we want to be together with our friends, but also with strangers, to be united by sound. Sound is the great connector, the great unifier. And what would it mean to expand that out beyond the human? Because I think one of the challenges of our time is, yes, of course, we need to listen to one another, and it's wonderful to listen to human music, but let's also listen to the music of the living planet. Could we imagine going, say, well, I'm going to make an appointment with my friends just, you know, this Saturday morning. We're just going to go and listen to the park and enjoy it for an hour together as a communal experience. And it seems like a very superficial experience, but I would say it's actually very deep, because listening to the voices of other species together with others is one of the things that made us human. Our ancestors have been doing this for millennia, for hundreds of millennia, and it orients us to place. It tells us what is the vibe, what is the energy of this place right now, so that next year and then the decade after that and the decade after that, we actually are tuned in through our senses to the real living world. It's, in a way, it's an antidote to fake news and to algorithms that are manipulating us. The birds are not lying to us. The crickets are not lying. The voice of the wind in the pine trees is disclosing something important and joyful, interesting and useful to us.
Mm. I wonder then, you write in your introduction, you say racism, sexism and power asymmetries create dire sonic inequalities. If you could just unpick that for us.
Yeah, so if you look at how cities have been planned, let's say there's a proposal, as there is in London right now, a proposal for a new busy road. In general, those proposals have directed roads and other sources of noise and other forms of pollution into low-income and minority communities. So that's a form of classism and a form of racism. It's been present in the UK, in the US. It was actually official government policy for many years, and the federal government subsidized putting interstate highways and bypasses through what were then called so-called ghettos, deliberately targeting Black and low-income communities to have noise imposed on them and to have air pollution of particulates. And so the burden of noise is unequally shared. And I think intuitively we all understand that the leafy high-income neighborhoods tend to be quite quiet, and they are generally quiet because they've imposed the noise that is required for human society as it's currently structured onto other people. And so there's injustice built into sound pollution. Luckily, though, sound pollution is something that can be changed. With new policies, we can change that. And we can both reduce overall levels of sound and make sure that we're not imposing sound pollution and other forms of pollution onto people who have maybe less political clout, less ability to hire lawyers and campaigners to work for them to keep their own neighborhood safe while reaping the benefits of having delivery trucks and airplanes and all the other things that the higher income neighborhoods certainly benefit from as well.
And finally, David, tell us about listening to the deep past and to the future.
Yeah, well, the deep past for me is a source of great imaginative pleasure, because reconstructing what the first insect sounded like, or thinking about how some of the evolutionary forces that we've talked about, what promoted the diversification of sound. I'll give you one other example, and that is the sounds of different continents, say Australia versus Western Europe versus North America. Every continent sounds so different because of the different sounds of birds and insects on each place. Why is that? The reason is buried in plate tectonics and the movements of animal groups from one continent to another tens or hundreds of millions of years ago. So as we listen, we're hearing deep time played out for us all around us in the soundscape. Thinking about the future, I think artists and musicians actually have a lot to offer us in terms of teaching us practices of close sensory attention. And I take great joy in the fact that now, across many musical genres, many creative people, composers and performers are inviting in the sounds of the more than human world into the human practice of music making. And I think that's a very healthy thing, because it restores music to its original place, which was in relation to the rest of the community of life. Think about playing a violin. you're hearing the second sound of a tree, of, you know, we're hearing wood and horsehair and metal ore in relationship to the artistry of humans. So if the composition can acknowledge that and can honor that, our imagination will be cast outward, and therefore our actions will be more firmly grounded in the realities of the living world, both the beauty and the brokenness around us.
That's just so wonderful. David, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be with you. I wish you many wonderful sounds this spring and summer.
Sounds Wild and Broken by David George Haskell is published by Faber, and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to the producer, Nora Hole, and researcher, Georgia Bispas. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.